This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by the University of California Press, publishers of Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry by Anna Zeta. Food and travel, they go hand in hand, and chances are, if you're a fan of Heritage Radio Network, you love them both. Between April 10th and 24th, we have six incredible food and travel experiences up for auction at charitybuzz.com. Go on an underground food tour of New Orleans with a rocket scientist. Get your hands on VIP passes to Feast Portland, or enjoy a ranch-to-table experience in wine country. Four of the experiences include hotel stays at some of the most iconic properties across the country, including the newly reopened Hotel Claremont in Atlanta. Now's your chance to win the ultimate bourbon and beyond weekend in Lexington, or take in a Latin food tour of New York's outer boroughs. You'll eat, drink, explore, and relax, all while supporting Heritage Radio Network. Help us keep the lights on and the mics hot. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/auction and bid now.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And I have a question for those listeners out there who are women. Have you been out for dinner lately with a group of your female friends? Well, consider it a privilege, and a privilege that was hard fought. In fact, it wasn't until 150 years ago that women were actually allowed to be served in a restaurant without an accompaniment of a male. And we owe it all to a particular woman named Jane Cunningham Crowley. In 1868, she was a reporter, actually quite a well-known reporter, a good reporter, and she had heard about a dinner that was being given for Charles Dickens, who was touring the United States. And the New York Press Club threw a dinner in his honor at Delmonico's restaurant. And she really wanted to be at that dinner, and why not? She was a reporter covering a lot of those articles about writers. But the press club refused, even though she was a member of the press club. They did, after she protested, they did concede to have her and other female members attend, but they had to stay behind a curtain where they could not be seen or heard. Well, that didn't fly too well with Ms. Crowley. She was a writer, and she wrote under the pen name Jenny June. She was so infuriated that she decided to form an organization primarily of professional women. And it was called Sorosis. Think of like sorority, not psoriasis, but Sorosis. It's a scientific term for the group of budding flowers that form a fruit. She got together a bunch of her friends who were writers, physicians, a minister. There were about 12 of them. And she decided that they needed to change things around town. So for the first meeting, she approached the owner of Delmonico's, and she did this just a couple of days after the Charles Dickens dinner. And she asked the owner, Lorenzo Delmonico, if he would host it, and he agreed, not knowing how risky that might be. But so he provided a dining room for the first meeting, and the women continued to meet regularly. And now remember, this was 1868. It was only a few years prior to that slavery had been abolished. And it wasn't even until 1920 that women gained the right to vote. So at times they were a-changin', for sure. Her choice of Delmonico's was really important, not only because it was where Dickens' dinner had been held, but Delmonico's, as you've probably heard on this show times before, was the first restaurant, well, actually, first establishment of fine dining called a restaurant in America. And that was in 1837 and has continued to operate since that time. So this is 1868, and this club met regularly there, and it was the first club run entirely and administered entirely by women. There were no organizations for professional women. Now, this was something that we don't really think about often, and fortunately, there has been some investigation into the past and into this meeting, and I am happy to say that today, as we record, it is April 20th, and it is the 150th anniversary of this first dinner and first meeting of this group of women. And I am honored to have been invited to that luncheon. And I am going to be interviewing some of the people who are integral in putting this together. The luncheon is being, as I said, hosted by Delmonico's. And a guest chef is preparing the food, and rightfully so, it's a woman, Gabrielle Hamilton. And she has, in her own right, it was an early female chef and restaurateur. So as we progress through the day today, talking about the history of women being able to dine alone, we will hear from Gabrielle as well. Now, women were able to dine, not dine, but they had special establishments where they could go out and eat. They were ice cream parlors where they could have dainty tea sandwiches because the women didn't want to eat a big steak, right? Right. Wrong. They were ice cream parlors where they would be, offered dainty eats. And there were some establishments where women of the elite class could go and dine, but they, again, just like the meeting that they were going to have with Charles Dickens, they would be able to dine in a special room behind a curtain where no one could see them. Because heaven forbid in that day and age, a woman dining alone would have been considered a woman of ill repute, and that was not acceptable. Well, times they were a changing then, and fortunately for us, they are still changing. So while it might seem like ancient history that women couldn't dine alone in restaurants, think of what women haven't really been able to do since that time. In fact, coinciding nicely with the Me Too movement, this lunch fits in quite well with the awareness of women being able to pursue careers without harassment and go about their business as anyone else would. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear from some of the women who have been integral in putting this luncheon together.
A century and a half ago, when the American food industry was first taking root, few consumers trusted packaged foods. But with the advent of canning, consumers were introduced to foods made by unknown hands and packed in corrodible metal that seemed to defy the laws of nature by resisting decay. Since that unpromising beginning, the American food supply has undergone a revolution, moving away from a system based on fresh, locally grown goods to one dominated by packaged foods. How did this come to be? New from the University of California Press, Can delves into the story of the canning industry, taking us on a journey to understand how food industry leaders leverage the powers of science, marketing, and politics to win over a reluctant public, even as consumers resisted at every turn. Pick up Canned by Anna Zaidi, available now wherever books are sold.
Hi, and we are back, and it is a wonderful dinner. 150 women all together, luncheon, excuse me, not dinner, it was a luncheon. 150 women all together in one room. The only men in the room were the ones serving. I thought that was kind of nice. And sitting with me is a very special person who has a very special job.
that I never knew about, and I'm sure a lot of other people have not known about. She is Jackie Ebanks, and she is the executive director of the New York City Commission on Gender Equity. Jackie, you gave some very inspirational words before the luncheon got going, and I thought if you could share with us gender equity, a commission on gender equity. Who knew? When did this start?
Well, thank you for your kind remarks about my work, my words, but the commission started in 2015 by Mayor Bill de Blasio. He created this commission to ensure that city agencies work together to remove institutional barriers to equity and to establish inclusive policies and practices. And the commission's work is to support the city agencies in delivering on this commitment so that New York City becomes indeed the fairest big city in this country.
Oh, and we hope that all the other cities then follow suit, right?
Yeah. Trying to lead by example. What we hope is, and we know that when we create inclusive policies and practices, all people, regardless of gender identity, or gender expression, will create many opportunities to be economically secure. That these individuals will live safely in their homes and in their communities. They'll have access to quality and affordable health care and will have full autonomy over their reproductive lives. And that, in essence, gives us the ability to thrive as individuals, and our city is richer and more productive for that.
Right. And you kind of gave us all these women, 150 women sitting there celebrating the right to be able to dine alone. Well, that's rather a luxury, but you did sort of throw a mission out to us.
Yes. You know, the beauty of events like this luncheon is the opportunity to reflect on the past and to reflect on the benefits that we have gained because of the labors of our foremothers, if you will. And when we do so, we also need to recognize that we are foremothers to a next generation. And therefore, our question ought to be, while celebrating the legacy and the gifts of the women who came before us, what is it that we will pass on to the women who follow us? What is it that we pass on and create for ourselves today? And so I really wanted us to think, as we celebrate, that we are women in places of incredible power and incredible opportunity. How do we leverage our privilege to serve others? How do we leverage our privilege to ensure that we build a more inclusive society? How do we leverage our privilege so that we promote equity and we dismantle marginalization and that we dismantle inequality?
Excellent, yeah. And the whole thing just kind of coming, you know, on the heels of the Me Too movement or in
Absolutely.
The same time as the Me Too movement.
Coming in on the heels of the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement, and I really do want to give a shout out to the young people who have led in the Black Lives Matters movement, in the Dreamers movement, in the Parkland, the young children from Parkland High School. And I also want to, you know, today is National Student Walkout Day. Mm-hmm. And so our young people, again, are demonstrating their force as they enter into adulthood with the right to vote. They're recognizing their power and they're speaking truth to power and they're determining their path. And I think as older folks, some of us, we have this opportunity to support them, to engage with them, and to be their partners to create this better world that they seek.
No, excellent, and thank you so much, and good luck in all that you do for the city. And I do hope that all my listeners out there, my listeners are all over the country and
Great.
All over the world
Great.
Too. So I hope that they will follow your lead.
And we appreciate that. I'm hoping they could visit our website, www.nyc.gov/gender-equity, and get a sense of the work we do. We many opportunities for partnership. This work doesn't happen without full public engagement, and
Excellent.
We want
Absolutely.
To
Absolutely.
Build partnership with the public.
Right, and finding out about it through food. I mean, who knew? food is that common language.
It is that common language.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me, and I hope you've enjoyed the lunch.
Did. Thank you so much, Linda.
As I had mentioned at the top of the show, 150 women dining, getting the privilege to dine after 150 years. 150 years ago, we couldn't have done this, had this big luncheon. And there are many different facets that go into and play into organizing an event and of this magnitude. And I have with me the sales and marketing director and creator of special events for Delmonico's Restaurant, Karen Serafian. And Karen, welcome.
Thank you so much.
You did such a marvelous job.
Thank
the
you.
Luncheon came off without a hitch, at least to those of us sitting at the tables.
And to me too.
It was wonderful.
Thank you.
But tell me, how did you conceive of this idea? Was there anything in the records? Did you know that this special luncheon of these women existed 150 years ago? Were those records kept somewhere?
We did know there was a luncheon that was held on April 20th, 1868. And two years ago, we celebrated sort of quietly and internally. We did something within the restaurant. And last year I said, you know what, let's make it a little bit more out there and a little bit more over the top. So we hosted a smaller version of this luncheon. And then because it was the 150th anniversary, I really wanted to make it a huge celebration. And that's how we had 150 women here today.
Yeah. So in the records of Delmonico's that existed, because I know there moves and buildings and changes of, were there records of this dinner?
It was actually a luncheon,
and the way it was
started is sort of interesting. All the detail behind it. There was a banquet honoring Charles Dickens, and it was being held by the New York Press Club. And there was a woman that was part of the press club that wanted to participate in the banquet to honor Charles Dickens. Her name was Jane Crowley, and she was not permitted to attend the banquet, and she was very, very upset about that. And she really was persistent in saying, you know, I'm a member of the press club, I'd like to honor Charles Dickens. Finally, the press club relented and said, okay, you can attend, but you have to be behind a curtain. You cannot be seen, and people can't. You can't be seen; they can't see you, and you have to be hidden away. Obviously, she wasn't going to go for that.
Well, and she had a name. I mean, she had quite a name in her own right as a journalist.
She was a journalist. Yeah. I think her pen name was Jenny June.
Jenny June, right?
And she decided that answer was not satisfactory. So what she did was she gathered some other women that were in the same position, a lot of journalists, a lot of professional women, and she knew that there would be a group of them that would want to meet on a regular basis to discuss politics of the day, whatever was happening in that particular era. And she approached the Delmonico brothers and said, we know we cannot attend the Charles Dickens banquet held by the New York Press Club, but we'd like to have our own separate from them. And the Delmonico brothers, being as progressive as they were, agreed to that. And that started the first women's movement, really, when you think about it. And they continued to have lunches and dinners and banquets and meetings for many years after that. As a matter of fact, I think there's still some branches of the Cirrhosis Club still in existence.
You know, I did. I actually saw that online when I was doing some research on the club and the name of the club, and that they do exist in some areas, all small groups, but they do exist, and it's wonderful. And then I spoke to Jackie Ebanks, of course, about gender equity, and it's never a more opportune and important time for an event like this to occur. And
absolutely.
I congratulate you on the effort and putting all the pieces together.
Thank you.
And the chef Billie Oliva giving over the kitchen to the guest chef, which rightfully is a woman. We'll be talking to her shortly.
Right.
And I look forward to what next event you might pull off, because you do an excellent job.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining me. So in this celebratory luncheon, of course, last but not least, certainly not least, we have to talk about the food. And the food was not a small component. It was a wonderful luncheon prepared by James Beard Award-winning chef and restaurateur and writer Gabrielle Hamilton. Gabrielle, welcome.
Thank you so much.
You laugh, and you laugh because you're glad it's over. You're tired.
It's just fun to hear myself
described.
Yeah,
yes,
it's nice.
It was a wonderful luncheon, and those of us sitting at the tables were saying, "Wow, this is a lot more food than we normally eat at lunchtime." But then I suppose that had to do with the period. Were there any records available as to what was served at the first luncheon 150 years ago?
In fact, there is the menu from that luncheon, and Karen from Delmonico's can provide it for you. Have you seen it?
No, I didn't get a chance to look at that.
I looked at that, and then I also had seen some of just original menus from here, not specific to the women's lunch, but it's just an eating style at the time. And I don't think you have to eat so much. It's just that there were so many things available. So
how did you make your choices as to what you were... You didn't follow the menu that existed from
I
that
didn't.
Time.
I didn't. I just read through all of those menus and looked for things that popped out to me as still relevant or vital or delicious or evergreen, sort of classic things that would really work for me. And there was plenty. So I saw lots of bouillon, and
yes.
So that was easy for me to do. I've been into beef bouillon, you know, or brodo, I guess is the new
yes.
phrase. But of
yeah.
course, that has contemporary feeling, and so many vegetables, of course. There were so many vegetables on the menu, and some of the sauces. Anyway, it was actually quite easy. It was very easy to... find the classics that are evergreen and curate the menu. Which is pretty much my only skill set in life. I shouldn't say my only skill set in life, but I feel like that's something I am good at, is knowing what to order or what to cook or what to eat.
Well, the first course that we had was...
That was humor and deliciousness. It was maybe too clever or not, but I thought it's very delicious, it's very funny, and it's fitting. So it's a classic, it's called Malakoff, and it's Swiss. And, you know, the Delmonico brothers were from Switzerland.
Right.
So I was just,
you were having
patting
fun
myself
with it.
On the back that I had a delicious item, an historic item, and a Swiss item in one bite. So... I hope you'll congratulate me on that cleverness.
I didn't get the humor with the Swiss.
Okay.
with the Swiss.
Well, here
dish,
I am
now
to
I
explain
know,
my joke,
get, right.
which is that's the best way. It
yeah.
shouldn't be too funny.
And it's
just
great,
subtle. But
it was a great fried, breaded, and fried.
Yeah, it's Gruyere.
Right.
It's a Gruyere mixture, and you put it on a little crouton, and you deep fry it, and then we made a lively... It has some shallot and some Kirschwasser and a little nutmeg inside. So it's kind of like a cheese...
Beignet, almost,
yes.
in a way. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then you had the cornichon,
then
the
parsley.
We had
a very lively, astringent sort of tonic salad to go with it of parsley leaves and cornichon, capers, and shallots.
I thought that... I liked that very much. I was struggling to get any kind of historic perspective, but now you've explained it, so I know.
It's from the late 1800s.
However, we went into the next course, which was the fish course. As I say, more food than I had expected to eat, but it was typical of the time. So the second course was a fish course.
So we had blue fish, and I made a little pickled celery and a mayonnaise, a very loose, silky mayonnaise from the poaching liquid and the court bouillon. So we had made a pretty lively corbillon to poach the celery in, to pickle the celery in, and I reduced some of that with some of the fish fumet that we poached the mackerel and bluefish with, and then I reduced that and made a very loose mayonnaise from that. So, yeah, a little piece of cold poached bluefish and mackerel. So that was one of the things from the early menu that you can see also, is that the it was not, I guess there was some Dover sole actually, but it's the darker, oilier.
Darker fish, right, exactly.
So, and you know, you don't see a lot of bluefish these days.
No.
And we were psyched to get it.
And then the entree, the main entree, of course, was quite expected, from me at least, a chop, you know, and a lamb chop. That was an excellently done. It was a very nice preparation with, and you added the spring vegetables, which were, you know, lively and beautiful.
That is actually from the original menu. So the sauce Colbert, the Colbert butter is... tarragon and parsley and shallot and butter and a little bit of demi-glace, and sauce Colbert is on the first menu, and the lamb loin chop, not so much. There would have been a blade chop.
A blade, right.
But we thought there was the too many muscles and textures in a blade chop would be sort of inappropriate for lunch today. Yeah. I just was like, let's get a little loin chop. And originally I'd wanted to have a soft shell crab, but it's been quite cold and we're a little early. So we changed the menu item at the last minute there and went with the lamb chop and, yeah, buttered peas and asparagus.
Yeah, I thought it was very, very classic, very classic 19th century.
Yeah, but I mean, you could also eat that now.
Well, exactly. And nobody would even, I was looking for the historical references.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think anyone else even blinked an eye, you know.
Nope.
It was very good.
That's the thing. You know, I'm always into the pleasure principle at the top of the consideration. So I want the food to be delicious and not so historical or, you know, or so funny or so clever or so technique. It's just first and foremost.
As a proven award-winning chef, I don't think you have to worry about that. You know you do that and do it well. And then there was a lovely dessert, not heavy, and it was...
lots of puddings on those original menus.
So
a lot
of puddings.
This was a rice pudding and a brulee, because I like it so much.
A deconstructed brulee,
which was just a pragmatic consideration also, because I like a bruleed rice pudding, and I couldn't brulee 180... a la minute, and so I made the brulee sort of opaline, you know, that the long tablet of burnt sugar, and just laid them on top of the rice pudding.
It was as beautiful as it was delicious.
It was pretty.
I didn't hear any complaints at my table.
No, and you know, it's so fun. I don't really eat dessert, but I really love to play around with it. And the fun part of cooking here at Delmonico's in this immense dining room with the wood paneling and the tablecloths and the big chop plates with the gold rim, which is so opposite of what I do at Prune in our little, you know, telephone booth. So
that's right. You have to describe for listeners who may not be familiar with Prune.
How many
seats are there?
Well, it's not the seats, but how many square foot feet have we shoved those seats into? So it's, you know, the tiniest, as we say, it's the tiniest restaurant on the face of the earth.
It is one of the smaller restaurants in
It's so
in
cramped.
New York City.
It's 30 seats, and all the tables wobble, and there's no room to do your work. But we, you know, we cram in there and have a
Again,
good time.
Again, I haven't heard any complaints.
I know. Well, you know, I complain
well.
Sometimes, but it is what it is. But anyway, my point is, it's so fun to be in this, you know, to use a metaphor. It's like if you're just used to driving the Volkswagen Bug, it's really fun to get in the driver's seat of a very big car. So in the dessert realm, it was fun to, make the brulee opalines and to make our little strawberry meringue kisses and, you know what I'm saying, to make a composed plate also.
Well, I thought it was a marvelous choice that Karen...
Nice.
Made to ask you to be the chef for this occasion.
Did it make
20 years you've owned a restaurant and been the chef owner of the restaurant. A woman, which was And that in itself is something that was unheard of. So you were sort of a groundbreaker and game changer and at that time as well. And I read something that you said in one of the interviews, the articles in a newspaper about this event coming up, and something about opening doors and the importance of
keeping them open.
Yeah. I don't know if you can reconstruct it, but...
Yeah, I mean, people have asked why I was drawn to do the meal, and, you know, I don't think... I am so driven by female chef events in particular, only because the kitchen is so, for me, gender blind. It's so, can you cook?
Yeah,
great. I really don't care what you look like or what your gender is. I really don't care anything about you, but
can you cook?
Are you coming to work today? And are you good at it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in my experience in the kitchens, it's in fact, my gender has meant very little. But, you know, you want to make sure, as we're saying, the doors, once they get open, you want to keep them open. And that's why I did the... Yeah, it's important to just make sure everyone knows you're there and we're still here and we do this work. And
well, it was an eye-opening event, I think, for... I noticed in the room there were a lot of, it seemed, younger women in the food media world.
Right, that's the only thing that I would say. I do think when you walk into a restaurant and you see all women in the kitchen, it's still as arresting visually. It still is a sight. In the same way that when you see a female cab driver, you see a female trucker, you still turn.
Right, no,
you're like,
yeah.
whoa. You don't see that so often, that all the line cooks are women, or the bartender. You know, it's still noticeable.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I did notice the women in the room today. That's right. It was predominantly very young and very white eating. But were you upstairs when we paraded out the entire staff who worked on this meal?
And it was a rainbow staff.
It
definitely
was a quintessential kitchen staff. It was exactly like every kitchen you've ever worked in your whole life. It was.
Yeah, every denomination and every gender.
Male and female, tall, short, fat, skinny, brown, browner, white. anyway, the whole world is here in the kitchen. So I thought it was important for me, only for me, to bring the whole staff out, because it represents the world that I really
Well, and again,
to.
it was all talking about equality, and this was... I mean, this is what the luncheon was about, was, you know, equal opportunity and equality, and that was great. And the people, the diners in the room, the women who were invited, many from the public relations world of food entities, a lot of people involved in food media.
I don't know how the invitation list got made. So
I
had a nice list of people that I thought were quintessential New Yorker women, and we sent out invitations. I think I don't know what happened, if they came or not, but it was does it matter who's on my list? But
no.
I thought it was it would have been fun to have that room. So I had like Jerry Jones and Justin Vivian Bond and Charlene Huntergall and Jenna Lyons and Melanie Dune and Mimi Sheraton. I just thought
Mimi was here.
She did make it.
Oh, Mimi Sheraton was here.
She definitely shows up.
She didn't come downstairs for the cocktail hour. I sat with her on the couch for a while. She said,
at 93 years old.
Well, I can't
old.
Walk up and down the stairs that much. I'll just wait till everybody comes back
She's
upstairs.
She's so good.
But she
She's
was
so
there.
Good.
She sat through it. She's going. She said, I'm going to do a piece on this. Mimi Sheraton, for those of you who don't know, she has been a restaurant reviewer and food writer for
umpteen years. She was at the New York Times. When was she? In the 60s, I think. Yeah, late 60s, early 70s. And she is still sharp with her pen and
her tongue,
yes, absolutely. And
so, but the young,
but and she was there, so she, you know, she perhaps was cognizant of a lot of the sentiment of the original reason for the luncheon, women being able to go out. I mean, she's not 150 years old, but you know, knowing that it's not as it wasn't as relaxed even then in the 50s and 60s as it is now. You know, when did you, you know, when you go out with a group of your girlfriends and, you know, you're very relaxed about it and you go to a nice restaurant, any restaurant, and imagine not being able to have done that. And I think this was an eye-opener for a lot of the young women who were in the room. I think this was something that they had never been aware of, and hopefully this will, you know, just be another layer of that whole, as you mentioned, keep the door open, keep the opportunities open. I mean, things were not, you know, available to everyone at all times. So
that was the law was that you could not eat unchaperoned.
Unaccompanied by a male escort. Well, today that escort has, you know, other meanings. But yeah, and you know, well, first of all, there weren't that many fine dining restaurants. Delmonico's was the first and the only one for quite some time, and then it followed suit in all the other cities around the country very soon after that. And here we are. We can, so next time you think about that, next time you call up your girlfriends, those female listeners out there, when you call your female girlfriends and say, hey, let's go celebrate. I just got a new raise. Let's go to, let's blow it all out at Delmonico's or some fancy restaurant. You don't even have to blink an eye. 150 years ago, it couldn't have happened. Thank you, Gabrielle, for participating in this and making it such a wonderful event, such a celebratory event.
It was so fun for me. Thanks.
And thank you to Delmonico's as well. And thank you to all my listeners for listening. This has been another Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.